most of the new concepts in the morning when we are still fresh and have some energies, and then will in the afternoon we'll do more of paper reviews. So if some people cannot be here, it's not too much of a big deal, as well as for all of us who are here and are tired, there is more of a review of things that we have already looked at rather than totally new concepts. So the idea today, and here I cannot use the, so let's do it this way. So the idea today is to go mostly through RNA-seq approaches. We saw yesterday that transcriptomic approaches have been developed to answer two big questions in biology. The first one is what are the transcripts? What is the whole description of transcripts that are present in the cell? And this is a big question that, as it has been solved, it has really changed the way in which we look at gene expression, gene construct, and those kind of things. The second aspect is to analyze the level of expression of all these transcripts. So the qualitative and the quantitative aspect. The big changes in terms of quantification happen with microarrays. Microarrays, as we discussed them yesterday, for the first time allowed us to measure the quantity of gene expression on a large base, and with the newest microarrays, the oligonucleotide arrays, to measure gene expression on the whole genome level. In terms of the first problem, so the annotation of all the transcript, microarray didn't really change the lay of the land too much, because we could only analyze things that were already known. So what is still remaining a big question, and this is what we'll address today, is how you go after looking for new transcripts for all the things that had not been annotated yet. And so we will quickly go through a couple of techniques that have been used to approach this problem before the advent of next-generation sequencing, and then we'll focus for the rest of the day all on RNA-seq, and we'll go through the basics of how RNA-seq work, how the protocol can be adapted to the type of things that you are interested in interrogating, as well as we look at how you go after data analysis in order to obtain annotation information or quantitative information. Just so that I don't forget, at the end of the slides for today, I put some extra material on different next-generation sequencing platforms. We will not discuss that in class, and it's not required that you know about all the different sequencing machines, but I just thought that I would include some material in case you are interested in knowing how they work, because during the class I will mention different machines a couple of times, and so if you are interested in knowing how they work, I put some information in the slide as well as a couple of papers in the bibliography that you can look at. Okay, so in order to address this question, that is how we annotate the entire transcriptome and how we go after things that have not been annotated yet, in the past there have been a couple of approaches used, and we'll look at them today. So the first one is tiling arrays. This one without the computer doesn't work, so we'll do it like this. Tiling arrays, and then SAGE and CAGE. And we'll spend a few slides looking at this, and then we'll move to RNA-seq and other sequencing approaches. So the first thing is tiling arrays. We kind of touched upon that a little bit yesterday. What we said is that with microarrays, you cannot interrogate things that you don't know, because you need to prepare the microarray by printing sequences on them. And so the way in which microarrays are usually built is with sequences that correspond to known genes, known coding or non-coding regions. However, in theory, you can use tiling arrays. You can use microarrays for discovery purposes. If you were able to design microarrays where you can print sequences that cover the entire genome, and then you use them just like you use regular microarrays, then you could use them for discovery purposes. And this is the idea behind tiling microarrays. So the idea is that you don't design the sequences that are printed on the array based on the coding information in order to cover the known genes, but you just design probes that overlap each other and that covers everything. They cover transcribed as well as non-transcribed region. And then if there is a transcript in this area of this intron, for example, then you would be able to pick up this transcript, so an unknown transcript in this case that you don't know about, so you would not normally design probe for those, for that. However, if you have a tiling array that covers the entire region, then you would be able to pick up signal from this area, and so you can use it for discovering new transcript. The problem is the quantity of sequences that you would have to put on such arrays. So if you want to cover the whole genome, the numbers are, I think Michele did some calculation, that you would need more than 50 million probes. So this is beyond the capacity of existing arrays. And so people have used them for a while before next generation sequencing was developed to look at specific area of the genome, not at the entire genome. But let's say if you had a specific question, you knew that there were mutations in a certain area of the genome that were associated with a certain disease, and you wanted to investigate that specific part of the genome and see whether there were non-coding RNAs there, then you could use this type of approach. The other approach that has been used quite extensively for a while, it's something that is called SAGE or CAGE. So there are two separate approaches, but similar in the concept behind them. SAGE stands for Serial Analysis of Gene Expression, and CAGE stands for CAP Analysis of Gene Expression. The idea behind both of them is it's something that we've already discussed yesterday a little bit when we discussed about EST tests. So the idea is that if you want to get information in order to identify transcript, you don't really need to sequence the entire cDNA. You can sequence tags and then annotate those tags based on the corresponding genes, and that gives you information about those transcripts. So the difference is that in this case, for SAGE, there is the attempt at making it a more high-throughput approach by sequencing many tags at the same time. And they do that by digesting the cDNA and getting little tags from each of the cDNA, and then each tag gets concatemerized into a linear DNA sequence that get cloned into a plasmid and then sequenced. And so by doing one sequencing run of this plasmid, you get information about a lot of different tags that are represented in the plasmid. So the preparation for SAGE and CAGE is different. Mostly because of the way in which the RNA and the cDNA are initially isolated. So in the case of SAGE, you initially separate the RNA based on beads that can bind to the poly A tail. And so you isolate them based on the 3' end. And then you use, you don't really need to know, I'm sorry that on this one the slides is not very clear. You have copy of all the PDFs anyway. But it's not important to know what the enzymes are. The thing to remember is the way in which the system works, which is to use enzyme to cleave the cDNAs that have been captured so that you can expose little tags for each cDNA, and then you cut them, ligate them, make concatamers, and then you sequence them. And there is, just like we discussed yesterday for the EST, there is some quantitative information in here as well, because if you have a tag that is represented very often, this comes from a CDNA that is initially represented more often in the original library and therefore correspond to a transcript that is more highly expressed. And so you can calculate the number of tags that you get from each of different tags and get some information about the expression of the corresponding transcript. What is more interesting, because it has led to some more interesting discoveries, it's the idea of cage. So cage is similar in the sense that you are just sequencing a small tag. But the big difference is the way in which you capture the transcript at the beginning. And you capture them based on the fact that they have a capped at the 5' prime of the RNA. So you have studied transcription in previous classes, right? And you know that there is a cap that is added at the 5' prime end of messenger RNA as they are after they are transcribed. And so if you think about it, if you isolate things based on the cap, you are sure that you are always isolating the 5' prime end of your transcript. Because if it's not the 5' prime end, the cap is not present. The cap is always added at the 5' prime. So the idea behind this approach is it's very simple. You isolate things based on having a cap, and then you perform the reverse transcription, or you perform the reverse transcription first, and then you capture them. But then you cap with an RNA that is single-strand specific. What does that mean is that it's an RNA that cut only when it finds a single strand of RNA. It doesn't cut double-strand RNA or doesn't cut double-strand hybrids RNA, cDNA, RNA DNA. And so if you think about what we discussed yesterday about RT and the fact that it's not always highly processive, when RT transcribe here the complementary strand of this RNA, there can be two different situations. One where the extension goes all the way to the 5' prime end, and one where the extension stops somewhere before, right? So if you cut these two forms with the RNA that is single-strand specific, it will cut only this one and not this one. So in this way, you get rid of all the transcripts that have not been fully extended. And the only one that you end up sequencing are this one, because then you purify things based on having the cap. And so there are a couple of ways to do this. This is just a different graph to explain the same concept. You have the capped mRNA, you do the first strand cDNA synthesis, and then you separate things with two different approaches, but the idea is exactly the same. One is a column that has attached proteins that are cap binding proteins. So there are proteins that recognize specifically the cap of the mRNA, and that is physiologically relevant because of the process of transcription. But in this case, it's not used for any transcription-related processes. It's just used to isolate those caps. So it's used as a trap. If you have something that binds the capped mRNA, you attach it on a surface, then you let all your RNA pass through. Only the one that has the cap will attach to the column and will be purified. Here the idea is the same. The only difference is that instead of using proteins that bind to the cap, you modify the cap. So you biotinylate the cap, and then you use beads that are regular streptavidin, avidin beads, and will bind to the biotin. The idea is the same. You are just not specifically selecting for the cap based on cap binding protein. You are selecting for the cap based on the fact that the cap is the only thing that is biotinylated. Okay? And then you cut with the RNAs. The ones that are not complete are removed, they're lost, because they're cut here or here. And so they don't remain attached on the column. They are washed away with the flow through. The ones that are attached are the ones where the extension has been completed all the way to the end, the one with the yellow cDNA. So then when you sequence the yellow cDNA, you get information about the real start site of a transcript. And this is critical. So this is a technique that has really allowed to define the transcriptional star site of many, many, many genes. Because to understand where the transcript starts tells you where the transcription star site is on the gene. And if you know where the transcription star site is, that's how you can identify the promoter region. And so then you can study transcriptional regulation. If you are not sure where the transcription starts, it's very difficult to identify the regulatory elements. Okay? So because of this, cage has been very important for identifying transcription star site and promoters. It has also moved on with the times. So while other techniques like tiling arrays have just been used for a while and then kind of abandoned, cage, because of the advantage that presented, was adapted to be used with next generation sequencing. And so while at the beginning people were using this approach to make libraries, and then the libraries were sequenced with Sanger sequencing, just like we discussed yesterday for EST and cDNA libraries and everything, in what here it's called cage 2.0, this application was adapted to be associated with next generation sequencing, so that you prepare the library in such a way, but then you sequence it by deep sequencing. And in this way, you can really interrogate the transcription star site of the whole transcriptome at once. And so most of the work with cage, not all of it, but a lot of it, has been done under the name of the Phantom Consortium. This is a project that started the beginning of 2000, I believe. It was run by the Riken Institute in Japan. And the idea was to annotate all the transcription star site and the functional elements in the genome. And because they had developed this technique, they really went after using cage to identify all the transcriptional star site. And so this is one of the papers they published, one of the most important papers in 2005, where they show that by using complementary approaches, they've been able to identify the 5' and 3' boundaries of almost 200,000 transcripts. And this has now increased, I think, even higher. If you are interested in learning more about this project, you can go on the CAGE website that is held on the Riken Institute website, where they report all the data that they have been able to identify. And they show you how they have performed CAGE with thousands of samples, so different cell types, different tissues, and this has led to identify more than 185,000 promoter sites. So again, remember this connection, because we'll discuss more of that within the next module after Easter. The idea is that we'll study how promoter is regulated and how transcription from an answer is regulated. And in order to be able to do those studies, we need to know where the promoters are. And the initial steps to be able to identify promoters is to identify where the transcription starts, because the promoter is right there. Okay, so I think this covers more or less how things were approached before the development of next generation sequencing. And these graphs simply give you an idea of how quickly things have moved, how quickly things have changed. So yesterday we discussed about looking at transcriptomes through spotted cDNA microarrays. This was in the 1990s, 1995, this paper. Really the beginning of looking at the expression of genes in a parallel manner, so looking at more genes at once, but it still required the effort of making cDNA libraries, spotting them on microarrays, and so on and so forth. This quickly changed with the development of more modern microarrays that we discussed yesterday. But within 5 years, everything changed again, even more dramatically with the beginning of RNA sequencing. And so that's what we'll be focusing on from now on for the rest of the day, RNA-seq. RNA-seq has really changed the way in which we have been able to study the transcriptome, both from a qualitative and a quantitative manner. And it really changed the way in which we appreciate now the complexity of genome organization and gene expression. Okay, so this paper here, this is a review from Nature Review in Genetics, 2009, which you can use as a reference textbook for the RNA-seq. And I'll go through a few of the figures, not all of them, but it gives a very good explanation of the whole RNA-seq procedure and all the different things that you have to take in account. So this is the first figure from the paper, and it basically gives you just an outline of how an RNA-seq experiment works. And so there are three main phases. The first one is the preparation of your sample, then there is the sequencing itself, and then the data analysis. And each of them, it's critical and can introduce biases, has to be controlled for and properly analyzed. So the sample preparation, in a way, it's nothing different than what we have looked at yesterday when we were discussing old-style Sanger sequencing of cDNA libraries. So you take your RNA from your cell tissue of interest, you make cDNA, and then either the RNA directly or the cDNA is fragmented, and we'll get into the specific of the fragmentations. Adapter are ligated to the side of the fragments, and then using this adapter, everything is sequenced. So every fragment that is produced is sequenced, and that's the huge difference, that instead of sequencing single specific cDNAs or little tags, we are now sequencing large number of a large sample of the library. Not the entire library, and we'll get into that. Depending on the sequencing depth, we'll be sequencing more or less of your entire samples. But the sequencing is it's extensive, and that's why these techniques are called deep sequencing. The length of the reads that are produced by sequencing depends on a number of things. Depend on the platform, the machine that you use for sequencing, as well as it's a cost choice. So as a customer, you can choose how long you want to sequence. And depending on what you want to do, there are reasons to choose longer or shorter sequences. And we'll go through that as well. Then the second big part is the data analysis, right? Because you end up with huge number of sequences, small reads. You need to analyze them. And so the first point is to map those reads to reference genomes and then analyze them so that you can look at how they correspond to existing transcript, new transcript, how you can quantify them. One thing to keep in mind is that there are different types of reads, and we'll again look at them. But these figures, I think, represent nicely the fact that there are going to be a lot of reads that come from exons, because you are starting with a material that is mostly processed RNA. And so you will get a lot of exonic reads, and those are the ones that are more easy to map because they correspond to an exon, a single specific exon. Then there are going to be poly-A reads that are going to be difficult to map to single places in the genome because there is not that much specificity in that part of the transcript. And then there are going to be the junction reads. Those are going to be the hardest one to map. And we'll discuss that as well. But if you think about it, if you have an mRNA that has been spliced, you have in there a junction of the different exons. And it's very possible that the reads will happen at the splicing junction. And so we'll have some of the information from one exon and from one from the other. When you are trying to map these to the genome, in the genome you also have the intervening intron in between, which can be extremely big. And so that presents some limits and some challenges that had to be addressed at the level of bioinformatic analysis. Okay, so we'll just go through, what I would like to do for this part is we'll go through these different steps and discuss some of the challenges and some of the things that we have to keep in mind as we set up experiment. So first, starting with the sample preparation. The first thing is the size, the fragmentation. So if you think about it, you want to be able to sequence as much as possible, right? And some RNAs are short. There are short RNAs that follow, that are 20, 200 base pair, and those can be sequenced directly, because if you sequence long enough, you are able to cover the entire RNA without the need of fragmenting it. However, most of the coding RNAs are longer than that. They are longer than 200, 500 base pair. They can be in the range of a few KB. And so if you take them as they are, you would be able to sequence only the real beginning and the real end, and you will miss all the intervening information. So you want to fragment them. And usually, just because of the protocols, the kits that are used to make cDNA libraries for RNA sequencing, the cutoff is usually around 200 base pair. There is nothing magic about this number. So don't think that the RNA below 200 have a certain functional role. The RNAs above 200 have a different functional role. Some are encoding, some are non-encoding. Nothing like that. It's just a question of size. The protocols that have been developed to generate cDNA libraries use this cutoff, and so that's the cutoff that you find in most papers. But there is no functional meaning associated with this magic number of 200 base pair, okay? You can go about fragmenting the RNA in two ways. You can fragment the RNA first, and then run the cDNA, the reverse transcriptase reaction, and make small cDNAs for each of the fragment. Or you can do the opposite. You can first make the cDNA and then fragment it into small pieces. There are pros and cons to both approaches. Some platforms prefer one, some platforms prefer the other. The only thing to keep in mind here is that you need to keep in consideration the way in which the RNA has been fragmented as you do the bioinformatic analysis down the line. So each of the steps during the preparation of RNA samples for RNA-seq need to be considered and taken in account when you do the downstream analysis, because you are potentially inserting biases that have to be corrected or at least taken in consideration when you do the bioinformatic analysis. And so just to give you an example, this is the difference between, and I think, yes, this is from the review, from your textbook. This is the type of coverage that you get if you fragment the cDNA. So if you first make cDNA and then do the fragmentation, everything works, but you are biased against towards the 3' end of the gene. So you get a good coverage of the 3' end, much less coverage of the 5' end of the gene. And this is, do you have an idea why this is the case? Why would you get more information about the 3' end and not the 5' end? Same thing we discussed yesterday, right? When you do the RT, the reverse transcriptase at some point falls off. And so the beginning of the RNA transcription starts from the 3 prime, and so you get more information about the 3 prime and much less and less from the 5 prime. If you fragment the cDNA, the RNA first, it's like you do an RT reaction for each single fragment. And so each single fragment is well covered because you have a beginning and that is in the middle of the gene. Does that make sense? Yeah. And so if you choose to do the RNA fragmentation, you get better coverage in the middle. However, you get less coverage on the end because you get a lot of small fragments at the end that are lost in the cDNA preparation. So again, it's a choice, and that's, I think, one of the key things to remember about RNA-seq preparation, that there are a lot of little choices that you have to make along the way, and those will determine the type of results that you get. They have to be considered when you do the analysis, and they should be considered when you compare results from different groups or different institutes, because they may be reaching slightly different conclusion depending on the way in which the samples have been prepared. Other things that can change in terms of choices that you can make. So we have already discussed about the fragmentation. One big variable is also which is your starting material. So obviously you start with RNA, but you can start with different population of RNA. You can extract total RNA from the cell and sequence it all, or you can decide to focus on poly-A RNA. So you are interested in messenger RNA that has a poly-A, is translated, so you focus on the poly-A population. And so you can first isolate the RNA based on the poly-A tail and then go through your usual library preparation. Or you can choose to remove some form of RNA. So you can do either a positive selection or a negative selection, right? A positive selection is when you are selecting for something. So in this case, you decide you want to sequence only the poly-A RNA. And so you select for the RNA that has a poly-A, and then you go through the library preparation. Negative selection is when you want to remove something. And so one example is removing ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA is highly expressed in the cells, and therefore it masks other forms of small RNA and non-coding RNA that are expressed at very low levels. If that's what you are interested in, a good approach is to get rid of the ribosomal RNA. And so there are kits for sample preparation for RNA-seq that have what is called ribodepletion. So in the cDNA preparation step, there is one additional step that it will lead to the removal of all the ribosomal RNA. And so if that's the choice, then you get rid of all the ribosomal RNA. Again, both of them are fine. You just have to keep them in consideration as you go through the analysis, because you analyze, the bioinformatician will ask you, is this ribosomal depleted? Is not? What kind of library have you prepared? Because the analysis will be different depending on the approach that you are taking in preparing the library. Okay. So what else? We talked about the size. That's another big decision, whether you want to go with one end or paired end sequencing. You can do that with all kind of different platforms, whether you're sequencing on an Illumina platform or another one. And this is basically a choice, customer choice. When you order your RNA samples, you can choose whether you want to do one end or paired end sequencing. And what this means is that each fragment is sequenced only in one direction, or each fragment is sequenced from both ends, one direction and the other. Obviously, the more you sequence, the better coverage you have. but also the more you sequence, the more expensive it is. And so it's a balanced decision about what is your goal, what kind of information you are trying to gain from the sequencing, and how much you can afford to spend. So if you are interested in looking at differential gene expression analysis, so the same type of information that you can get from a microarray, what are the genes that are upregulated or downregulated, probably one end is more than enough. If you are interested in identifying new splicing junction, then paired end can be extremely important because it allows you to sequence on both sides and really define where the splicing junction is. And we'll talk a little more about this in a minute. Same thing for strand-specific RNA-seq. When you prepare the library, you can do normal cDNA preparation, or you can specifically prepare the cDNA from one single strand. Pros and cons with that, I think we'll talk a little more about that in a minute. But again, all choices that are not right or wrong, they just have to be adapted to the goal of what you are trying to do. The other variable is the platform that you use for sequencing. And so, in a way, all these variables that I described you seem overwhelming, right? And one reaction may be, how can you compare all the results that are achieved with all these different, slightly different approaches? And so there have been studies where people have tried to compare all this. And the conclusion, there is one thing to remember about all this, is that the conclusion is that there is not one perfect protocol that fits every size, but it depends on the final goal, the final outcome of your experiment. So this is an example of one of such study where they have compared results across 15 laboratory sites using reference RNA. So they've not compared different experiments. They've really taken the same population of RNA and then have it sequenced in different places using a lot of different variables. So this is the flow through of their approach. They started with the same sample, and then they did different things. They either sequenced on different machines, so they compare the results on an Illumina HiSeq, which is one of the most common machine used, the Ion Proton, the Roche, the Torrent. So they compare different machines, but they also compared different type of library preparation. So they compared what happens if you use poly-A enriched library versus ribodepleted library, as we just discussed. What happens if you treat with RNAs or you remove the RT with heat. So they compare different approaches. And their conclusion is, I think it's here, that if you're looking at expression information, gene expression profiles are very similar. Using all these different approaches, the correlation efficiency is very high. However, if what you are interested in is the analysis of splice junction and variant detection, then there are a lot of differences. And so that's exactly what I was just telling you. Depending on the type of information you are interested in, there are advantages in using one approach versus another. Okay, so the other... independently of how you prepare the library, whether you choose to go with the total RNA or selected RNA, the big question, the one of the main things when you do RNA-seq is quality control. Because no matter which is the library that you choose, if you put garbage in, you get garbage out. That's one of those bioinformatician computational way of saying that no matter how you analyze the data, if the data is garbage at the beginning, you're not going to get meaningful information out of it. And the same thing is for the RNA-seq. If the RNA that you are starting with, it's not very high quality, the RNA is partially degraded. If the RNA has been contaminated during the preparation, the RNA-seq results are not going to be good. And because of how expensive and how laborious the whole process is, it's very important to go through a lot of quality control checkup during the process and make sure that the samples you are using are good enough to give you meaningful information at the end. And so the first big step of quality control is the quality control of the RNA itself. Just check how the RNA look like before you start preparing the library. And the easiest way to check the quality of the RNA is to use a machine that is called the bioanalyzer. There are different type of models, but they more or less work the same. And what you get out of them is a spectra that look like this. And you can, if you compare, this is a good spectra. So this is the one that you hope to see when you send your RNA to the core to get it analyzed. You get very nice and separated peaks for the two ribosomal RNA, the 16S and the 28S. And then there is no degradation, so you get very little signal on the side. You also get very nice separation of the two different ribosomal RNA if you look at it on a gel. So this is it's a good prep. This is the opposite. This is a terrible prep. If you get something like this, no reason to send it to sequences. This is degraded RNA. There is not going to be any meaningful information that can be achieved out of this, and this is what the RNA look like if you run it on a gel. It's all degraded. But then there are intermediate situations, right, where the peak may not be as clean. It looks okay, but it's not perfect. And so the quantification of this type of spectra are done using a number that is called RIN, RNA integrity number. This is a number that goes from 1 to 10. 10 is the perfect RNA, 1 it's a totally degraded RNA. And there is a range in between. Different people go with different threshold. We usually don't sequence anything that is below 8, 7.5, 8. Again, it depends from your source of RNA. If you are like us, we work with cell line, with mice. If that RNA looks bad, we can always prepare more. So if it looks below 8 or 7, we just get rid of it and we get more to sequence. If you are working with RNA from patients, you have samples that have been collected in the hospital and you get a limited amount of RNA from each patient after a biopsy, you may not be able to be that selective. Yes?
So is this the RIN included in data analysis to having, fidelity on your significance in the results? Or it's only a control here to select RNAs and then go over?
Yes. So it doesn't have any impact on the significance of your result. It's just a number that gives you a measure of the quality of your RNA, whether it's degraded or not. And it's just a way to give it a number instead of relying on you looking at the spectra and trying to decide whether they are good or not.
So in the previous example, if I have a RIN of 8, 9, or 10, is a little bit the same for my data analysis?
Yeah, it's a little bit the same. The better it is, the more likely it is that you get good reads out of the RNA-seq, and then the mapping is going to be easier. Because if you have degradation, you're going to have reads that cannot be mapped. So the mappability of the reads change. But I don't know if anyone, it's a good question, I don't know if anyone has really made a study and look at whether a RIN of 8, 9, or 10, how much it corresponds to.
I guess maybe it's unbiased, the influence of...
Yeah. Sure. Okay, so if you are interested about how the Agilent, the bioanalyzer work and all this type of spectra, what do they mean? I have included in your, I think in the bibliography or in the additional resource material, I'm not sure, a a file that comes from bioanalyzer, from the Agilent, and that's the one we use in the lab where we receive the samples, we go through that and we check whether it's good or not. There are all the intermediate cases and they clearly show you spectra by spectra what has gone wrong in that RNA. Okay, so the quality control does not stop with the RNA. You also need to do quality control at other steps. You need to check the raw reads that come out of the machine before you do any analysis, because that's a measure of how the sequencing process itself worked, whether there was any problem with the machine, whether the adapter had not been removed, those kind of things. And then you do check on the aligned reads. And so, don't worry about the slides. I'm not going to discuss it in any details. It's just to give you an idea of how many steps there are in an RNA-seq experiment where quality control is important. So, as I said, you start right from the beginning. You have your samples, and the first thing you check is the quality of the RNA, the read integrity number, as well as the concentration. Do you have enough to do an RNA-seq experiment? Sometimes you isolate samples, you are working with very few cells, and you don't have enough to sequence it. And then at each step, if there is something wrong, you remove the sample that should be discarded so that they don't affect your downstream analysis. Then there are a lot of quality control steps after you get your raw data. So you sequence and then you get the raw data, which is called, usually it's a FASTQ file that comes directly out of the sequencing machine. So you get these raw data before they are analyzed. There are a number of things that usually the bioinformatician run directly and they check the amount of GC, the distribution of the nucleotides, just a number of, they run a number of pipelines that allow them to check whether the sequencing has worked properly or whether there was a bias in the library so that it's extremely rich in GC and that's not something that it should be or other things. And then once you go through this quality control step, then, and you have removed samples that may not be right, then you can process the sample. And you can start align them to the genome, use the aligned data to run additional quality control, and then finally get to your final report with the quantification of the sample. Okay, so perfect. I was thinking we could just take a small break here, and then after that we'll move into the data analysis part. Okay, so data analysis, that's the second part of the RNA-seq procedure that we should discuss today. So I think the main idea is that once you get all these reads out of the sequencer, you want to map them to a reference genome. And so, and understand where they fall so that you can define transcript based on that kind of information. This is the most common way to go about analysis for RNA-seq data. There is, however, the possibility of going with de novo assembly in case there is not a reference genome that can be used. This is not really an issue for human mouse studies or commonly used organism, but it can be a concern if you are studying lower organism or things that which genome has not been fully sequenced yet. And we'll touch upon that very briefly in a minute. The main thing is I think we should consider the analysis of the RNA-seq data from two different point of view. One is the point of view of annotation. As we have said, RNA-seq all of a sudden allows us to interrogate the whole transcriptome at once, and so to annotate new transcript, get a full picture of what is the RNA, what are the RNA forms that are present in a cell or in a tissue at a certain specific time in development, for example, or in response to certain treatment. However, that is not something that is currently done, that is often done by single labs. So this kind of big annotation project are projects that have been conducted on national and even international basis by consortium of different laboratories. And we'll discuss this afternoon more in detail some of the results that have been achieved through project like ENCODE. What you do in the lab, so if we run RNA-seq to get information about a knockout mouse model, so if you run it to identify gene expression patterns in tumors, studies that are more similar to what we have looked at yesterday with microarrays, then what you are interested in is less the annotation and the prediction of transcript, and is more the quantitative aspect of how you can quantify known gene, how you can quantify splicing variants, and those kind of questions. So I think this is a distinction that you have to keep in mind when you think of RNA-seq and when you read about RNA-seq paper. They read very differently if they are annotation papers where they really go through the to the prediction of novel transcript and the annotation of the transcriptome, or papers where RNA-seq is used more as a tool to measure gene expression analysis. The other thing is that often this part is the bottleneck for RNA-seq experiment, because the analysis is more complicated than it was to look at the results of microarray experiment, and often it needs dedicated bioinformaticians that can go through the analysis and run all the appropriate pipelines. It is becoming easier and easier to run RNA-seq analysis in individual labs, even labs that don't have bioinformatician on staff, because the pipelines are now being designed, and if you have limited knowledge of bioinformatics, you can run them. However, as soon as you get out of the standard analysis and you want to do some more integration studies or interrogate your data in a different way, then you really need to be able to collaborate with the bioinformatician or to have a bioinformatic core at university that does this kind of studies. And I think this is where we are right now. A big limiting factor for a lot of these studies is the analysis power rather than generating the sample and sequencing them. Generating a library, as we discussed, it's easy. You have to make some choices about which kind of RNA you want to work with, but after that, it's a kit. And then you give it to the sequencer, you put it in the sequencer, and you get the results out. The problem is that what you do with the results when you get them. Okay, so just briefly about the novel assembly. As I said, I'm not going to go into the details of it. I wouldn't have the knowledge to do that. This is more of a bioinformatic problem of how you can analyze the reads in such a way that you can assemble transcript without the knowledge of a reference database to work with. But I think it's important to know that those are two alternative possibilities. When you talk about RNA-seq data, usually people map them to a reference genome. So you take all the reads, and there are specific programs that can be used. They are called aligner, that take all the reads and align them to your reference genome. And so if you are sequencing a mouse sample, you will align it to the mouse reference genome. And then you go from there for the follow-up analysis. However, there is the possibility of not going through that step, but using different type of bioinformatic tools to assemble the transcript by combining all the different tags in such a way that you build all the possible transcript, even in absence of a reference genome. Again, this can be important for organism where you don't have a reference genome to work with. Some people have been running those kind of experiment also in case of organism where you do have a reference genome. to see how comparable the results were and whether there were area of the genome that had been incorrectly assigned and that could impact upon the analysis of the transcriptome. Okay, so from now on, what I'm talking about is not the novel assembly, but is the classic way to go about aligning the mapping the sequences to the genome. And so, as I touched upon earlier, there are easier and more difficult reads to assign. So, exon sequences, exon reads that fall completely into an exon are more easy to assign. They're more easy to be mapped to a unique region on the genome, whereas regions that overlap, reads that overlap a splicing junction are more difficult to align. And so people usually, what they do is that they use different alignment tools. There are general ones that you use at the beginning for all the exonic regions, the exonic reads, and then there are more specific tools that can be used to map splicing junctions. And then the question is how you can predict novel transcripts. So usually it's a two-step process where you first map all the sequence, all the reads that you have obtained, and you look at all the known transcripts. And so you have reference databases with all the known transcript, all the known splicing junction, and you see how much of your reads will fall on these things that are already known. The things that are outside of those are potentially new transcripts. The question is whether you have enough power in your RNA-seq to define new RNA transcripts. And what I mean with that is that a lot of the RNA forms that we had not annotated yet prior to sequencing was because they were very low expressed. And we'll discuss more about this today. But in general, if you think about it, if you have RNAs that are very low expressed, you are going to get very little number of tags. So if you... if there is something to write with it. Yes. If you have a genome, right, and you know that there is an area that is transcribed, and in this area there are different exons, this is exon 1, this is exon 2, and you get a couple of tags here and a couple of tags there, you already know that these are exon, you know that this is a transcript, so the fact that you see very few tags there, it's just an indication of the fact that this transcript is expressed at a very low level. However, if you get exactly the same result, but from a region where you don't know that there is a gene, you don't know that there is a transcript, it's an intergenic region, or it's a region that is previously not been linked to any existing transcript, and you find a couple of reads here and a read here, it's very difficult to understand, to know whether these are indication of a transcript that is expressed at a low level, or whether these are just random tags, background noise that you are getting out of the sequencer. And so a key question here is how deep is your coverage of your RNA sequencing. So when we talk about sequencing depth, what we are talking about is how much of your original sample you are sequencing. So when you sequence, you never sequence everything. You don't get to saturate completely and sequence every molecule that is in your preparation. You always sequence a sample of it. Okay. The question is how big this sample is, how much you are sequencing. The more you sequence, the higher is the sequencing depth. And so ideally, what you want to do is to reach a saturation point where if you sequence more, you are not going to get additional information. So you are reaching a plateau where you have gained as much information as possible. Sequencing more will not tell you more, will will just fall in the same categories. The same transcript will be identified, the same gene will be found to be differentially expressed. Does that make sense? Kind of, yeah. So, however, saturation can be different depending on what is your goal. So if the goal is to find new transcript, the saturation is when you reach that point where if you sequence more, you are not going to get more new transcript. You just keep finding the same one over and over again because you are just going to get more and more reads on the same spots. You are not going to get sequencing reads in places where you had not seen them before, right? This is different from reaching saturation for differentially expressed genes. So here you are not looking at identifying new transcript, you are just looking at whether genes are up or down regulated. And you need less information to get to this second answer than the first one. Because since you are looking at known genes and how differentially they are expressed, you need lower coverage to be able to cover the known area and know whether they are upregulated and downregulated in a comparative manner. So the sequencing depth, again, is a choice. It's not an absolute number. There are plenty of discussions right now about what is the ideal sequencing depth. And it depends on a number of things. It depends on the on your goal, whether the goal is to identify new things or to measure gene expression. It also depends on the complexity of the genome that you are studying. So if you are, this I believe is from your review, if you are looking at yeast, yeast don't have splicing, so it's a much less complex genome than the human or the mouse one. And so here they have checked how the number of transcripts that are detected correlates with the number of tags that have been sequenced. And so you see that there is a strong increase early on. So the more you sequence, the more number of transcript that you can identify, but then you reach kind of a plateau. And by the time, so the red line here, you have a coverage that is about 80% of the genome, with the green is only 50%. So if you are, if you have about 1 million map tags, you reach only 50% of the coverage. The other 50% of the genome has not been sequenced, so you don't get information about it. However, when you reach 4 or 5 million tags that have been mapped, you have reached already about 80%. And the more you increase, you get a little more, you get up to 90, but then it kind of plateau. These are very different numbers than what you need to use if you're looking at the mouse genome, for example. But again, it's the same type of curve. You still get to a plateau, you just get it with a different number of reads. And so that is, again, a choice in terms of cost. You can sequence more. If you run one single lane from an Illumina NextSeq machine, I believe you get 250 million reads. You can choose to sequence only one sample in that lane, and then you will get 250 million reads only for that one sample. Or you can choose to multiplex and put 10 samples in there. But if you do that, then you get about 25, 30 million sequence for each of the samples. And that's really a choice. So depending on what you are interested in doing, you can choose to sequence more or sequence less. But it's important to keep in mind that in the case in which you are trying to identify a new transcript, then you need to have a higher coverage to be able to identify them. Then if you are looking at gene expression difference, where probably a coverage of 30, 40 million tags is sufficient. Okay, the other reason for which you may need a higher coverage is to map splicing isoforms. If you're not interested in splicing isoforms, you can get away with the lower coverage. If you want to map splicing junction, you may need a higher coverage. And the problem we've already looked at it a little bit earlier is the fact that when you have reads that are overlapping with a splicing junction, you have, these are short reads, right? Let's say you are sequencing with the 36 base pair or maybe 70 base pair. That's a choice. Again, you can choose the length of your sequences, the reads. Usually it's either 36 or 75. Then this is split in between two exons, so it's harder to map. The ideal case is one where it's splitted more or less in the middle, and so you have enough information on both sides to be able to map it to an exon, even though there is a large intron in between. However, there are cases that are not as easy, like one where most of the tag will align to one exon, and then there is a little piece at the end that you don't know where it maps. And it could be mapping to two different exons, for example, in this case, because it's such a short sequence that it's not as specific as a long one. So you could find this in many different places in the genome. And so this is an important question, because if this was to map, were to map here, then it would mean that this exon is splicing into this exon. However, if this tag is wrongly mapped here and it should have been mapped to an exon down the line, you are missing the fact that this transcript doesn't look like this, but it looks like one where this exon is splicing into here and this exon has not been, is not expressed. So these are critical questions, and imagine this is one read. Imagine when you are considering all the millions of reads that you are getting out of sequencer, and the high number of splicing sites that can be that exist, that are known, and the one that you are trying to discover. So obviously, increasing the sequencing coverage helps, because you are not going to get only one read here that will encompass these two exons, but you're going to get more than one. And so there may be this one that it's hard to map, but there are maybe other that are better placed. They have more information about the second exon, and that helps to identify the transcript that is really existing in nature. The other way to improve mapping for those kind of problems is to do longer reads. As I said, that's also a choice. When you send a sample to the sequencer, you can choose the length of the sequences that you want to get out of it. And so the longer you sequence, the more expensive it is, but in some cases it may be worth it, because if what you are interested in is mapping all the splicing sites, longer reads will help this problem, because if this one was a 36 base pair reads and it has this problem, if this instead is a 75, it's more likely that the second half has enough information to be mapped correctly, right? The other way to improve mappability of splicing site is to do pair end sequencing. So instead of sequencing each read only from one end, you can sequence them from both ends. And that's just a different protocol on the sequencer machine. It's represented here, but you don't really need to know the details of how the machine works. It's just enough to know that you have adapters on both sides, and what the sequencer does is that it sequences first one side and then the other. So you first do one first cluster and sequence the first end, and then you regenerate clusters and sequence from the opposite direction. And so that, again, helps in this kind of problems, because if this is a sequencing read that belongs to a larger fragment of RNA, here you are sequencing from one end and you are getting this kind of information, but here there are going to be more information that is lost. If you are also sequencing from this side, you are also getting more information about this part, and so the mappability of the junction site is going to be easier. And then finally, the strand-specific RNA-seq. As I said, it's not very common, but it can be useful sometimes more than for splicing junction for antisense transcription. So if you think about it, sorry, I don't have a slide about that. If this is a gene, and you know that there is a transcription start site here, and then it goes in this direction, and you're gonna get reads that map all the way here, right? However, it is possible that in this region there is also an antisense RNA that is transcribed in the opposite direction here, for example. This is a non-coding RNA, so it is a transcript. However, it falls in the same region of a known coding RNA in the opposite direction. So the sequencing reads that you are getting from this region, it's difficult to know whether they belong to one of the transcript or the other, right? Because they fall exactly in the same, they map on the same area. However, they could come from this transcript going in this direction or from this non-coding RNA going in the opposite direction. So one way to help the mappability of these kind of things is to have a strand-specific RNA-seq where you are sequencing only things that come from one of the strand and then only things that come from the other strand. And that helps the mappability because this type of the reads that correspond to this non-coding RNA will come only from one strand and the other from the other strand. Okay, and then finally, the last thing to keep in consideration about the difficulties of the challenges of mapping splicing junction is that you could even have a situation in which you are not splicing into the same gene, but you are also splicing into a different gene. And this is the case when you have fusion from two different genes. So those are often disease state where you have a translocation or a fusion. And so when you are trying to, you are mapping all your reads, and you first map the ones that correspond to the exon of these genes, then you map all the ones that correspond to the splicing junction, and you identify junction between these two exon and junction between these two exon. And then you have some reads that are still, that still cannot be mapped, because maybe they have part of this exon here, but then they continue with something that is not a following exon, is something that is unrelated. And so this is what happens in the case of reads that encompass fusion between the two genes. So in this case, you need to be able to map this first half of the reads on this gene, the last exon of these genes, and then the second part into this other one. And so this has been actually, has been useful. RNA-seq approaches have been useful to identify new gene fusion events that were unknown before. However, in order to be able to map these things, you need to have higher enough coverage and probably pair-end sequencing and long sequence so that you can be confident about the mappability of each read. The last thing I wanted to say before we move to quantitation, it's about the confidence. So, yes, you increase confidence by increasing the coverage, increasing the depth, the sequencing depth. You increase confidence by having longer reads. However, something that should not be forget is that you also gain confidence by running a replicate experiment. So the two things don't exclude each other. And so sometimes it's better to, if cost allows only for a certain number of experiments, rather than achieving a very high sequencing depth for one replicate that cannot be controlled for, it's better to get a lower sequencing depth for more replicates. Because from the replication, you will also get more reads that will align to different areas. And so you will gain confidence about whether those transcripts, especially the new identified transcripts, are real or not. And in fact, all the experiments that we look at today have been run by the ENCODE project and other big consortium have all been run in very high replicate number. This is often not possible for single labs, but especially for mapping, for new annotation, it's an important aspect. Okay. Quantitation. So this is what small labs more often use RNA-seq for. You run 2, 3, 4, 5 samples, and you are interested in understanding how gene expression change from one sample to the other, how the transcriptome change, which are the genes that are upregulated, downregulated in a significant manner. And so the easy way to visualize this is that you count the tags. Right? So you have tags that are falling all over the genes, you have mapped them, and then you count them. The more tags you have, the higher expression you have. However, you can't really rely on simply counting the number of tags. Those tags need to be normalized. And so you cannot use absolute reads number. And the reason for that is is dual. The main reason is size of a gene. So think about it. You have a huge gene with 20 exons and tags falling all over the gene on all the different exons. Normal number, let's say something like this, right? But imagine the gene, instead of having 3 exons, has 20 of them. So if you count all these tags, you get a pretty high number. If you have a small gene that has only 1 or 2 exons, but have lots of tags here, you may not reach a number that is higher than this, but this doesn't mean that it's expressed at a lower level. You have to keep in consideration the size of the gene, because the number of tags is proportional not only to the expression levels, but also to the size of the gene. And so, in order to normalize for size, people use something that is called RPKM. It's a unit of measure that stands for reads per kilobase per million. So included in this number, there are two normalizations. One is what I just told you. It's normalized for the size, and so that's why it's called reads per kilobase, because you are counting the number of reads that are falling into a comparable unit of length. But you're also considering the reads in consideration to the total number of reads that you are sequencing in that experiment. So you are also inserting in that number a normalization for your reads total, whether it's 30 million, 50 million, 70 million. And so the first thing you do is that you divide the read counts per million, and that gives you the reads per million. So how many, because you want to know how much this is represented within your sample, right? So whether it's something that is overrepresented within your sample, something that is highly expressed, something that is not highly represented is a low expressed gene. And so you first divide per million, and that gives you an idea of how represented those sequences are within your general pool. And then you divide them for the length of the gene, and that gives you the kilobase normalization. Okay, and then same thing than what we discussed yesterday for microarray, right? Because what you get out of all this KM calculation are Excel sheets where for each gene you have a certain RPKM value. You can calculate the ratio between RPKM between different samples, and you get all kind of numbers. And then the way you represent them is exactly the same we discussed yesterday for microarrays. So you can use heat maps, for example, where just like we said yesterday, each line is what? Do you remember what each line is in a heat map? It's a gene. Yeah. So each line is a gene and each column is a sample. So in this particular case, it's just an example. It's a graph. If you think about, you are profiling the transcriptome from cells at different stages of development, from stem cell to a fully differentiated, let's say it's a muscle cell. So what you do is that you represent the value, the RPKM value, in a false color representation, as we said yesterday, for each of the genes. And then you can use this kind of representation to look at cluster of gene expression and see how genes that are together in terms of changes correspond to different biological pathways. And so in this case, for example, you can imagine that genes that are highly expressed in the stem cell sample but then are decreased as differentiation proceeds are things that have to do with stem cell and pluripotency, whereas genes that are upregulated only in the latest stage of differentiation are genes that are specific for that tissue once it's fully differentiated. So in this case, cardiac function, if that was, so it wasn't muscle, it was heart. Things that are in between are likely things that are important during the differentiation, so things that can have to do with the precursor of the final differentiation stage or lineage determination. One little philosophical consideration. We'll get more into it tomorrow, but if you think about it, what we have discussed today, the more information we are getting about transcript, how the transcript are expressed, how widely present they are across the genome, the harder it becomes to talk about gene expression level. So it's probably more correct to talk about RNA expression or transcript expression rather than gene expression. You will still find gene expression levels everywhere in papers. But just keep it in mind that it's something that is difficult. The concept of gene is changing, and we'll discuss more about that tomorrow. But if you think about what we just discussed in terms of splicing forms, you may very easily find that there are isoforms that are highly expressed within a certain gene, whereas other isoforms are very low expressed. So if this is gene X, and it has two isoforms, one that has three different exons and one that skips this exon here, this one may be highly expressed even though the other one, the one that includes this exon, is not highly expressed. So when you talk about high gene expression or low gene expression, you are actually not talking about the entire gene. You are talking about a specific transcript, a specific isoform. And so it becomes difficult to talk about gene itself because many genes have tons of different isoforms, and some may be expressed, some may be not. So it becomes important to differentiate between transcript levels or gene levels, or at least when there is knowledge about different isoform, to specify which isoforms we are talking about. Okay, so briefly, this also brings around the question of how you quantify alternative splicing sites, because if you think about it, it becomes a complicated thing to do, right? Because you can have different tags falling on all the different exons, but some transcript within a certain gene may be more expressed than others. However, there are going to be some exons that are common between the different isoforms, so those will have a certain number of tags. And then some others will be specific to a certain isoform. So I don't know if I can draw in a decent way, but and we'll look at this more tonight, this afternoon. But if you just consider there is a gene that has potentially skipping an exon here, so you can have one transcript that has all three, and another transcript that has only the first and the third, and then doesn't have the intermediate one in, right? So when you quantify them, you are going to have reads that follow in this area. The reads that correspond to the common region have to give you information about the quantity of both isoforms. The one that is expressed only in one isoform, it's easier because this one gives you information about this particular transcript. And so this is a bioinformatic problem. There are ways to address it, and we'll not get into the detail. But there is one thing I wanted to introduce, because you will see it in one of, I think, in your research paper or one of the other papers we discuss, which is the idea of splicing graph. So this is just a way of representing different splicing isoform, but it makes it easier from a bioinformatics standpoint to analyze the expression of different isoforms. So if we look at a very simple case, the most simple case is where we have one gene with two alternative transcripts, one that has the red exon, so exactly that specific case, right? If you think that the red exon is the one in the middle, you have one form that has expression of all the three different exons and one where the intermediate exon is skipped out. And so you can represent each of them with its own tags, or you can represent them as a kind of like a graph where you represent all the exons and then you use arrows to represent the possible splicing events happening. Now, this seems totally not useful if you look at something like this where you have only two options, like what do you gain from this? However, it becomes very useful when you start looking at more complicated cases where you have a lot of possible alternative options. And so this, for example, it's a case where you have an exon that can be skipped, as we discussed before, but you also have two potentially alternative star sites, as well as a differential splicing junction here that leads to a longer exon. And so in order to describe all these different possibilities with one single representation, people use this kind of graph where you use these arcs to show what are the possible splicing events. And so here you have two alternative star sites. Both of them will splice, two alternative first exon. Both of them will splice into the third one, and then the fourth one can be kept or can be spliced out, and so on and so forth. And so here it's just a representation of how the different splicing event can be represented. So you have skipping of exons, you have alternate donor site, alternate acceptor site, an intron that can be retained. And this is important for your research paper, because you will see that they have identified all kind of different splicing junction. We'll discuss it this afternoon. And so this is a easier way to think about all the different splicing event. And then what people do is that they compute the expression of all the different isoforms by calculating how much each of these events is present in your RNA-seq results, and so how much of the different isoforms are expressed. This is the same thing, it's just a real case, to give you an example of a real gene where you can see there are all kinds of different possibilities. So the scale of complexity is really much higher than simply one exon that is skipped or not. And so that's where these kind of graphs become useful, because by considering all the possible skipping event, you construct a graph that allows you at the end to realize that there are not millions of possible transcripts. There are actually four possible transcripts. And this is the representation of the four transcripts. But this has been easier to visualize because people have constructed this type of graph with all the possible alternative events. Okay, so to finish up, Yes, we have a few minutes, so just few general consideration about comparing microarrays, RNA-seq, other approaches. Why do you want to use one or the other? We have already said the other day the pros and cons of microarrays. One of the big pros is that it's easy to use, it's cheaper. RNA-seq, it's more expensive, it's harder to analyze. However, it has a much higher dynamic range. So the type of quantitative information that you can get is much more, not sensitive, but meaningful. Because you get information across all the dynamic range, whereas microarrays are sensitive only in the linear range, as we discussed the other day. Once you get into problem related to fluorescence, into the saturation of the fluorescence, then you cannot achieve meaningful information. RNA-seq doesn't have any upper limit, so you can keep reading in a linear range for much longer. The lower limit depends on the sequencing depth, as we discussed. So if you really want to get information about low-expressing transcript, you can increase the sequencing depth. You can increase, keep sequencing, and you will get information about the low-expressing, whereas with microarray, those are simply lost. And whereas if you are looking at things that are in the middle, that are mediumly expressed, there is not much difference. So if you are looking at things that are expressed within this linear range, so most of the coding genes, then there is not that much difference in the information that you can get by comparing RNA-seq and microarray. And this is what is represented in these graphs here, where people were looking at the correlation between RNA-seq and microarray data. And you can see that in the medium, where you have genes that are expressed at the medium level, then the correlation between the this is styling array and RNA-seq is pretty good, whereas when you get into the higher range or the lower range, then the correlation becomes extremely poor. This is more of the same. Advantages of the RNA-seq is that you can identify novel genes, you can find novel transcript, the dynamic range. This is an interesting aspect. There is less bias due to genetic variation. What do they mean with this is that if you think about it, there is genetic variation. There are SNPs, there are small single base variation when you generate RNA. If you are using an hybridization technique, such as microarrays, differences in one or two base pair can make a lot of difference in the ability of the probe to hybridize with your array. However, in sequencing, that's not an issue because you're just sequencing, so you sequence everything, you sequence the variation, and that's taken in account during the analysis. So during in microarray, you can lose information from forms that where you have insertion of genetic variation. And I think the others are pretty reasonable. Yeah, this is again, same thing. I just put a couple of tables for you to look at comparison between different techniques. This one doesn't consider only arrays and RNA-seq, but consider also cDNA sequencing and tiling microarray, so looking more at the qualitative aspect. And you can see there are differences in the background noise. This can be a problem for array, where it's less of a problem for sequencing approach. The resolution is different, the possibility of running out throughput examples, all that. Okay, so it's not tomorrow, but it's this afternoon. I didn't know I would be teaching this afternoon. We'll look at some of these things in the context of studies that have been done and papers that have been looked at. So nothing new this afternoon. We'll just go through papers about RNA-seq and look at the type of results that people have got.